Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. The 91st Academy Awards ceremony will be on February 24th. To celebrate, we're looking back at two of our favorite episodes featuring nominated actors. First up, Oscar winner Rachel Weisz, who's been nominated this year for Best Supporting Actress for her role as Lady Sarah in The Favorite. She reads Kristen Sherrold's essay, When Eve and Eve Bit the Apple.
When you were raised to be a good Christian girl, you don't just go to church, you date the church. Church is the significant other with whom you spend weekends and evenings, the boyfriend whose friends become your friends, the girlfriend with whom you share all your dreams. I was a really good Christian girl, so I didn't just date the church, I married it. After graduating from a Midwestern college whose motto is For Christ and His Kingdom, I moved to New York City. It was my first time out of the evangelical cocoon, and my priority was finding a church I could love, commit my life to, and make my spiritual and social center. My search ended in Brooklyn, where I found a church of young, creative people and fledgling professionals who, like me, were looking for a faith less burdened by fundamentalism. We forged a quick camaraderie, including with our pastor, who was as much friend and peer as spiritual leader. We hung out in the pews on Sundays, but also in bars and each other's living rooms throughout the week. Soon, this congregation became my beloved. I took my membership vows and began leading a Bible study, teaching Sunday school, attending weekly planning meetings, and signing up for countless other duties. I committed to this church with the vigor and joy of a new bride. Like most single women in my position, my next priority was finding a husband in this church. There is a motif of love triangles in Christianity. Like the love of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, Evangelicalism 101 also teaches the Holy Trinity of matrimony, man, woman, church. So I scan the pews each week, looking for someone with an unadorned ring finger. One Sunday, I noticed a new woman in a suede jacket, her short dark hair tucked under a brimmed hat. Our conversation was unremarkable, and yet I was captivated. I tossed out the most evangelical invite. Do you want to come to my Bible study? She did. Then she came over for dinner. Then she began sleeping on my couch. We met for coffee and whiskey and eventually lost track of who paid for each other's tabs. I convinced her that biking in New York wasn't too hazardous, so she bought a bicycle on Craigslist. When she crashed, twice, we went back to my apartment where I cleaned pebbles out of her skin and bandaged her ankle. Then we unknowingly went to a museum exhibition featuring gay and lesbian art, and I was forced to think about us but I wouldn't let myself acknowledge what was so painfully obvious. Over the following months, however, as Jess began stashing extra shoes in my closet and bringing home groceries to expand my diet of frozen burritos, I couldn't deny that I was falling in love. And with that realization, I fell off cloud nine and stared into the fires of hell. I finally came out to myself. Then I scrambled right back in. At stake was my soul and identity, my entire worldview and spiritual cosmology, my relationships with friends, family, God. That holy trinity of husband, wife, and church haunted me even as it slipped out of reach. It was a crisis of eternal proportions. I fell deep into an inferno of shame and panic. My fear of hell shut down any capacity to imagine a future with Jess. I repented of what Christians call my struggle with same-sex attraction. But still, I found incomparable delight in her. I read countless books on homosexuality, and yet clarity escaped me. Fighting for solace, I convinced myself that Jess and I were just friends. Well, that worked until one night when we went to the ballet and I kissed her and she told me she loved me. For the first time, I felt complete, loved, known. Lying beside her healed my past and present self. It also confirmed my worst fears. I woke up terrified. I needed to kick Jess out and end things with her immediately. But first, we had to go to brunch. It was the kind of brunch we couldn't skip, a going-away celebration for a good friend. We barely endured the long mimosas and eggs benedict as we contemplated our catastrophically changed lives, a la Adam and Eve post-fruit, full guilt. Finally, the check was squared, and we left to confront the reality of us. As we walked, Jess noticed a distraught homeless man standing in traffic. Never one to ignore a person in need, she called him over to the sidewalk where he began to share his story of the wounds life had inflicted upon him. Jess listened patiently. I stood aloof and awkward while she offered to buy him lunch. When they exited a nearby bodega, the man had a bag of food, a hot coffee, and something like a smile on his face. "How much?" the man asked. "Oh, nothing. It's a gift." "How much?" the man insisted. "Okay, well," Jess hesitated. "$1. He reached into his jacket and pulled out a coin purse, counting out 4 quarters and placing them in Jess's hand. Then he left. Jess looked at the quarters. "These are the most valuable things anyone has ever given me," she said. "I don't even know what to do with them. For most of my life, I had been given a slew of definitions around love and relationships that were easy to verify with scripture, just as a flat earth was once confirmed by looking at the horizon. But watching Jess interact with this man, I saw a new horizon, one that was more complicated. In Jess, I saw the love Jesus preached, one unconstrained by conditions and extended to everyone, especially the forgotten, the stranger. Jesus never mentioned homosexuality. His cosmology was not studded with creeds, crimes, and contempt. Its essence was loving the marginalized. Every fiber of Jess's being reflected this. She embodied the attributes Jesus was most passionate about: compassion, kindness, justice. How could loving someone who loved so well be wrong? I felt my cramped religious framework of false dichotomies and moral starkness beginning to collapse. What once seemed like a bleak choice between losing my soul or losing my most cherished friend was in fact a lesson that true love is the only thing that could save me. There was still much turmoil ahead. Many people opposed our relationship and insisted that if we loved each other, we didn't love God. Our pastor was one. We had first gone to him to confess what we then considered our sinful relationship. But over time, we discussed our evolved thinking with him, hoping that our years of faithfully serving the church would be our witness, and that our pastor, a friend, would agree to disagree where our theology diverged. Instead, he gave us an ultimatum: break up or lose the church memberships. Soon after, the church divorced us. Looking back through that messy love triangle between Jess, our church, and me, I kept asking myself what Christ's love required, and the refrain I kept hearing was, love your neighbour as yourself. Jess didn't usher me into only true romantic love, but also true agape love, showing me that the most foundational precept is the trinity of loving God and your neighbour as you love yourself. We eventually found a new church that champions this belief and embraces all people. I now have the joy of serving as an elder there. Two years after our first kiss, Jess and I sneaked onto an empty Rhode Island beach. Only a few stars and a cloudy moon illuminated our running and jumping as we let freedom eradicate our shame. As our eyes adjusted to the darkness, we saw a lifeguard tower and clambered up, with the ocean at our feet and the horizon at eye level. We sat side by side in the night air. Let's write something, Jess suggested, pulling out the journal we shared. No, let's just enjoy this, I insisted. The moment seemed perfect as is. Well, I'll write something and we can read it later. Jess scribbled and then handed me the open notebook, shining her phone's flashlight on it. The light was a shocking intrusion upon our private darkness, so I asked her to turn it off. Instead, she pushed the journal into my hands. When I looked down, I saw a hole cut out in the middle of all the pages. Inside lay a ring. My head spun. I waited for her to ask me those four fated words, but she was silent. The moment didn't need words. I took the pen and wrote, "Yes," on the page. She put the silver band on my finger and gave me a matching ring to place on hers. Then she asked if I remembered the homeless man we had met that morning after brunch. I laughed. Of course. Why? I figured out what to do with those quarters. They were melted into our rings. 50 cents each.
That's Rachel Weiss reading Kristen Sherrill's essay, When Eve and Eve Bit the Apple. After the break, Willem Dafoe.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
What do you do when the clock runs out on a relationship, when there's no more time left to ask the questions you want answered? That's what Bruce Eric Kaplan sorts through in his essay, Missing a Father I Hardly Knew. It's read by Willem Dafoe, who received an Oscar nomination for Best Actor in a Leading Role for his portrayal of Vincent van Gogh in At Eternity's Gate.
The psychic started to laugh. What? I said. After your father dies, she said, you're going to find out something about him. Something hilarious. Wow. What? They aren't saying, but apparently it's really funny. It's been going on for a while. Is it going on right now? Definitely. This is very frustrating, I thought. Is it sexual? I asked. I think so, but it doesn't have to be. I scrolled through the various possibilities to think of what it could be. Nothing felt like him. Obviously, she said, you must have sensed already that he had this surprising thing going on that you know nothing about that is just totally crazy and hilarious. I thought for a moment. No. Well, whatever it is, when you find out, you're going to laugh. This conversation happened 9 years ago. My wife was writing a television pilot based on a book about a famous psychic. We were having dinner with the psychic, and she did an impromptu session with me so Kate could see her in action. I say this to stress that the prediction came from someone a lot of people consider to be a very reliable source. When my father, Jerry, was dying just over 2 years ago, I kept thinking about how little I knew him, which isn't to say I hadn't spent time with him. I lived with both him and my mother in Maplewood, New Jersey, until I went to college. I talked to him on the phone every week when, soon after leaving college, I moved to Los Angeles. I came back frequently to see them, and then him, after my mother died. And in the last 5 years, I've worked on a television show that shoots in New York and saw him every spring and summer. But I am here to say we almost never talked about anything. Nothing. Zero. Once after one of our excruciatingly dull phone calls, I ran to the table where I draw cartoons and quickly did one of a man on a telephone saying, I'm not trying to say anything, I'm just talking. The week that cartoon appeared in the New Yorker, I spoke to my father and he chuckled and said, your cartoon was very funny this week. I was startled. First, he didn't often comment on my cartoons, but even more odd, it was about him, and I wondered, Does he know it's about him? And if he does know, shouldn't he be upset? And if he's upset, shouldn't I be upset? But since he doesn't sound upset, he must not realize it's about him. So he must think it's about other people. But he can't think that, because other people actually say things and he doesn't. Okay, we didn't talk about nothing, but nothing was ever really said. We basically talked about relatives, movies he saw, or books he read. But the conversation had to stay at a certain level or he would get frustrated or stay silent. Once, when he called me and asked what was new, and I told him my wife had had her third miscarriage in 2 years, he simply hung up the phone. When we were growing up, there was another Jerry Kaplan in Maplewood. We would get his mail sometimes. We didn't really know him, but there was something striking about the fact that there was this other Jerry Kaplan wandering around town, also taking the train to and from Manhattan each day. I wonder now if it was so striking because there was actually another Jerry Kaplan living in our house. The other Jerry Kaplan was inside of our Jerry Kaplan. My father would often start to say something, then say, "Forget it." It would be right when he was going to be real with you, say something he was really thinking. Then he wouldn't. It was almost as if he would be in danger if he did. Now, when someone starts to say something and then says, "Forget it," I get unnaturally angry. Starting to say something and then saying, "Forget it," is the worst thing you can do to a person, I say every time it happens. Which I don't really believe, but I do. I'm assuming my father learned at an early age that there is nothing more dangerous than showing your true self. I think a lot of us learn that, and it actually may be true. But many of us tried to unlearn that. He didn't. So all I can really tell you about my father is that he did odd things, like put tin foil on a bottle of beer after having a few sips, then put it in the refrigerator to perhaps have on another night. I don't even know if he actually had the beer in the subsequent days. It would sit in the refrigerator with the tin foil on it. He loved to sing, "Oh, you can't fool me, I'm sticking to the Union." As far as I know, he read every book written by Susan Isaacs, Rona Jaffe, Avery Corman, and Evan Hunter. He could be well-meaning. My mother always bought our birthday gifts. The first year after she died, he worked hard to get me a gift he thought I would like. He sent me Manhattan When I Was Young by Mary Cantwell. When I called to thank him, he was very proud of himself. "Didn't I get you the type of book you would like?" he asked. "Yes. I had to look for a really long time, but then I saw it and knew that it was the one to get." "You did a great job," I said. I didn't mention that I had already read it. In fact, I had given my copy to my mother and him, and it was in his house. When I was little, he would buy me a miniature chocolate pudding pie from the old German lady's bakery on Springfield Avenue. And when I was old, he would still buy them for me when I came to his house to visit. With the little chocolate shavings atop the whipped cream, those pies looked like tiny pieces of art. And my father had certain things he loved, like network TV movies, all network TV movies, any network TV movie. It could be about a woman in jeopardy, as so many of the women in them were, or a family in jeopardy, my favorite genre. Anytime a family went on a vacation, a motorcycle gang would torture them for no good reason, which was extremely unfair. Or it could be a comedic one about two women who switch lives. Or a melodramatic one where someone like a teenage Susan Day is wrongfully put in a woman's prison. Or a light romantic comedy about a woman who loses a lot of weight and gets a new life, played by Patty Duke. Patty Duke was in a lot of them. Then Patty Duke Aston was in a lot. Then Patty Duke again. Most nights, because they were on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, my mother would ask what TV movie was on. Night Terror, my father might say. As you might guess from the title, this was a Woman in Jeopardy one. Valerie Harper is driving across country by herself, and as often happened to these women, a stranger suddenly starts torturing her until, I think, she is forced to kill him in self-defense. They were almost always forced to kill the man in self-defense. What's it about? My mother would ask. It's based on a Sartre story, my father would reply, no matter what the movie was about. The first time, she really thought it was. Then it became their joke. Our joke, I guess. Because when I think about it now, I smile. So after my father died, I waited for what the psychic said was going to happen. Some big and hilarious secret would be revealed. To be honest, I didn't really believe it would, but I hoped. I wanted to find out what was really going on in that enormous bald head. It was my last chance, in fact. But as you may have suspected, I didn't find out a thing. Nothing private or interesting was revealed, and still hasn't been. And I guess never will be. So I'm never going to get that laugh the psychic said I would. And I will never really know my father. And that's that. It's a strange and sad thing to miss someone you never knew. On the other hand, he gave me so much I do remember. The nice things he would do, like buy me mini chocolate pudding pies, and the strange things like the tinfoil on the beer bottle, and the idea that no matter how banal, every story is based on a Sartre story. Probably even this one.
That's Willem Dafoe reading Bruce Eric Kaplan's essay, Missing a Father I Hardly Knew. We asked Willem why he connected with Bruce's piece.
Basically, I like the details in the story. They aren't from my life, but they felt very familiar and expressed something poetic. And then ultimately, I think about my father, who has passed, and I loved him, but I didn't know who he was.
Thanks again to Willem Dafoe. We've got more after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're going to do something special for the next couple of weeks. First, next week, we're going to revisit Amy Krauss Rosenthal's modern love piece, You May Want to Marry My Husband. It was published just 10 days before Amy died from ovarian cancer in March 2017.
Allow me to introduce you to the gentleman of this article, Jason Brian Rosenthal. He is an easy man to fall in love with. I did it in one day.
Amy's husband, Jason Rosenthal, wrote a modern love essay of his own, and we're going to share that one with you the following week.
Amy couldn't have known that her essay would afford me an opportunity to fill this same column with words of my own, telling you what has happened since. I don't pretend to have Amy's extraordinary gift with words and wordplay, but here goes.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Parati. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.